Welcome, and thank you for standing by. All lines are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session. At that time, please press star one and record your name as prompted. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn today's meeting over to Monica Allen. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for joining this media call today. Again, I'm Monica Allen with NOAA Communications, and I'll be facilitating the call today. Today, you will hear from two federal scientists who will discuss the U.S. Global Change Research Program and its legislatively mandated assessment reports. The first of these reports, the Climate Science Special Report, is being released today in final form. The report, which serves as Volume 1 of the Fourth National Climate Assessment, is an authoritative assessment of the science of climate change with a focus on the U.S., and it serves as the foundation for efforts to assess climate-related risks and inform decision-making about responses. In addition to the release of the final Climate Science Special Report, the U.S. Global Change Research Program also is releasing the draft versions of Volume 2 of the Fourth National Climate Assessment and the second State of the Carbon Cycle Report for public comment. Our first presenter is Dr. Virginia Burkett, who is the Chief Scientist for Climate and Land Use Change with the Department of Interior's U.S. Geological Survey. And Virginia is Acting Chair of the Subcommittee on Global Change Research. Dr. Burkett will provide the legislative context and the purpose of these reports. Dr. Burkett will be followed by Dr. David Fahey, who is the director of the Chemical Sciences Division at NOAA's Earth System Research Laboratory. And David is one of the coordinating lead authors for the Climate Science Special Report. Dr. Fahey will go into more detail about the development of the Climate Science Special Report and its key findings. Our first speaker is Dr. Virginia Burkett.
Good afternoon. My name is Virginia Burkett, and I work for the U.S. Geological Survey in the Department of the Interior. I'm speaking today in my role as Acting Chair of the Subcommittee on Global Change Research. I'm going to tell you a little about the U.S. Global Change Research Program, its legislative mandate, its structure, and its high-level objectives. I'm then going to briefly describe the Climate Science Special Report, which we are releasing today in final form, and I'll mention two other reports that are now available in draft form for public comment. The Subcommittee on Global Change Research consists of representatives of the 13 federal agencies that constitute the U.S. Global Change Research Program, or USGCRP. The USGCRP was established by presidential initiative in 1989 and enacted into law by the Congress and the Global Change Research Act in 1990. USGCRP's legislative mandate is to develop and coordinate, and here I quote the law, a comprehensive and integrated United States research program which will assist the nation and the world to understand, assess, predict, and respond to human-induced and natural processes of global change. The USGCRP has three major sets of responsibilities under this congressional mandate. One, coordinating global change research across the federal government. Two, developing and distributing products mandated by the law. And three, helping to inform decisions. The Global Change Research Act also requires that USGCRP conduct and deliver to the Congress every 4 years an assessment of our understanding of global change and expected trends and impacts for our nation and into the future. For your reference, the last National Climate Assessment, NCA 3, was released in 2014. For the current cycle, due to be completed in 2018, next December, USGCRP is delivering the mandated assessment in two sequential volumes. Volume 1, the Climate Science Special Report, fulfills the first set of the requirements of the Act. And as Monica mentioned earlier, it is the reason we are on this call today. By coming out first, the Climate Science Special Report allows the physical climate science assessment to effectively inform the impacts assessment, which will be in Volume 2. The Climate Science Special Report has undergone six rounds of review including by federal agencies, the public, the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. It is posted now for reading or download in its final form at science2017.globalchange.gov. Dr. David Fahey, a coordinating lead author of this report, will speak next, and he's going to tell you more about the assessment and some of its key findings. Now, Volume 2, which is posted in draft form for public review today, will complete the fourth National Climate Assessment. That 29-chapter draft report, Climate Change Impacts, Risk, and Adaptation in the United States, is scheduled to be delivered in late 2018. And finally, I want to mention a third USGCRP report entitled The Second State of the Carbon Cycle Report, we call it SOCR 2, is a technical input to the National Climate Assessment, and it is expected to be finalized next summer in mid-2018. These two draft reports are now available for public comment, and they will undergo simultaneous expert review by the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. The two draft reports can be accessed for the purposes of providing comments at review.globalchange.gov. Review.globalchange.gov. Please note again that these are draft documents. These latter two, they should not be cited, quoted, or distributed, as is standard practice for all draft reports produced by the USGCRP. Now, collectively, these three reports are written by hundreds of America's top federal and non-federal experts. They represent the consensus state of knowledge in this area as required by the U.S. Global Change Research Act, and they reflect the efforts of hundreds of volunteer authors and reviewers who are working tirelessly to make them a reality. And on behalf of the entire USGCRP organization, I want to convey our deepest gratitude to them for their ongoing contributions. Since Volume 2 of the National Climate Assessment and the State of the Carbon Cycle Science Reports are draft, it is standard federal policy for us not to comment on the substance of those reports, though we are happy to respond to inquiries today regarding the development and their review processes. The Climate Science Special Report, or we call it the CSSR, is available today in final form on the USGCRP website. I'd like to turn the floor over to Dr. David Fahey from NOAA's Earth Systems Research Laboratory. David is one of the three federal coordinating lead authors of the CSSR, and he is going to highlight some of the key findings in that report. David.
Thank you, Virginia. Good afternoon. I'm David Fahey. I'm very pleased to have this opportunity to introduce this group to the Climate Science Special Report as a representative of the author team. Today, I will describe key aspects of the report and some of the key findings, and later, Virginia and I will try and answer any questions that you may have at this early stage. This report is an authoritative assessment of the science of climate change with a focus on the United States and provides foundational information and projections for climate change and its impacts that will be addressed in Volume 2 of the National Climate Assessment. I would first like to draw your attention to what I consider a few key aspects of the report. The first is the author team. The author team gives the report its intrinsic merit. We were very fortunate that 32 climate scientists from around the U.S. accepted the task of a lead author, and another 19 served as contributing authors. The Scientific Steering Committee selected the report authors from federal agencies, national laboratories, universities, and the private sector based on their expertise, experience, and published research. The scientific authority of the report rests squarely on their shoulders. Second is the review process. The version released today is the seventh draft, which reached completion just a few weeks ago. Each draft faced a critical scientific review by experts that led to an improved subsequent draft. The period from first to last draft spanned about 18 months. We had several reviewing bodies, namely our Scientific Steering Committee, the general public, the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, and the 13 agencies of the USGCRP. These agencies actually conducted the final review of the report. The reviews added many, many independent voices to the process, and were substantial, creating many hundreds of comments. The USGCRP office coordinated these reviews and tabulated the comments along with responses and actions from the author teams. This open, transparent, repeated process assured the best scientific narrative and the most robust conclusions, and hence offers the reader, whether a scientist, a non-scientist, the public, or the policymaker, the needed confidence to accept the findings of this report without being an expert themselves. We are especially grateful for the National Academy's comprehensive review of the third order draft, conducted about a year ago by a separate group of U.S. climate experts. And to enhance transparency of our process, the responses of this Academy review, as well as public comments, are posted online for download along with the report. The third aspect is what I call the weighting of our results and key findings. This is done by attaching directly to the important findings a level of confidence and a quantification of the likelihood throughout the report. We consider this an essential way to manage what you might call the overabundance of climate science information available to the world today. The fourth aspect is what I would call the packaging of the report, designed to make the content and conclusions accessible in a variety of ways. We have 15 chapters, each containing a few key findings, several figure displays with metadata links, a list of supporting literature references, and traceable accounts section. Each chapter targets the expert reader with a detailed scientific assessment of a specific topic. A broader audience will be drawn to our executive summary. Considerable effort was made to distill the chapter content into one or more specific conclusions in this summary. It's organized around high-level conclusions, the gray boxes, followed by supporting bullet points, and in some cases by a figure. The summary language is designed to be clear and unambiguous with a minimum use of unfamiliar scientific terms. In this way, the accessibility of the report conclusions is enhanced for our diverse intended audience. And as a further step, we produced a highlight section of just 12 findings distilled from the executive summary. And finally, we have an excellent interactive website for the report that you may have already discovered. These valuable report features required a substantial effort by the editorial and design professionals at the USGCRP office and NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information. The fifth and final aspect is that the report contains no climate policy recommendations. Instead, we provide a strong scientific foundation that can be used to inform policy decisions related to future climate mitigation and adaptation in the U.S. So, taken together, the expert authors, the weighted scientific content, the extensive review process, and the professional packaging, this climate report is unprecedented for the U.S. and portends to be of unprecedented value in our national and international discussions of present and future climate change. So in the last few minutes, I will touch briefly on some of the scientific highlights. If you've been following the world's climate discussions, our highlights will sound familiar, although some details will be new. Foremost, we conclude, based on extensive evidence, that it is extremely likely that human activities, especially emissions of greenhouse gases, are the dominant cause of the observed warming since the mid-20th century. And for the warming over the last century, there is no convincing alternative explanation supported by the extent of the observational evidence. Globally annually average surface air temperature has increased by about 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, or 1 degree centigrade, over the last 115 years. This period is now the warmest in the history of modern civilization. Global average sea level has risen by about 7 to 8 inches since 1900, with almost half of that rise occurring since 1993. As a consequence, the incidence of daily tidal flooding is accelerating in more than 25 Atlantic and Gulf Coast U.S. cities. More sea level rise is projected. The report addresses changes in the characteristics of extreme events, which are particularly important for human health, infrastructure, agriculture, water, and ecosystems. These topics are central to Volume 2 of NCA 4. For example, heavy rainfall is increasing in intensity and frequency across the United States and globally is expected to continue to increase. Heat waves have become more frequent in the United States since the 1960s, while extreme cold temperatures and cold waves are less frequent. The incidence of large forest fires in the western United States and Alaska has increased since the early 1980s and is projected to further increase. Annual trends towards earlier spring melt and reduced snowpack are already affecting water resources in the western United States, and these trends are expected to continue. Long-duration hydrological drought is increasingly possible before the end of this century. It is important to note that the magnitude of climate change that will occur beyond the next few decades will depend primarily on the amount of greenhouse gases, especially carbon dioxide, emitted globally. And finally, on a more positive note, there are indeed emission pathways which enable the U.S. and the world to remain below 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit or 2 degrees C of warming. We show these in the report. Almost all of these mitigation pathways, however, except those with the most rapid near-term emission reductions, are heavily reliant on the implementation of CO2 removal from the atmosphere later in the century or other climate intervention. So I'll pause there and thank you for your attention and turn this over to Monica and Brady to facilitate questions.
Thank you, Dr. Fahey. Thank you, Dr. Brickett. Now we're going to be taking your questions, and I'd like to ask the telephone moderator to explain again how reporters can ask questions.
Thank you. At this time, we'll begin the question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment from the phones, please press star 1, make sure your phone is unmuted, and record your name and your company name to introduce your question. To withdraw that request, you may press star 2. Once again, for a question or a comment, it is star 1. One moment, please, for our first question. Our first question or comment comes from Seth Bornstein from Associated Press. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you for doing this, and I have a follow-up. If we could turn to Chapter 15, compound potential surprises, compound events, compound extremes, and tipping elements, can you explain sort of in more layman's terms how serious, you have a list of a dozen tipping points, how likely you think any of those 12, how many of them are likely to happen in general in the next, by the end of the century or some whatever time frame you want. So in other words, how would you characterize the likelihood, the seriousness, the consequences, and the importance of these tipping points? And is it fair to say this is one of the first times a science report has spent so much time on tipping points?
Yes. Thank you for that question. Chapter 15 is an important chapter in this report because it's kind of points to the fuzzy parts of climate science understanding, and one of those is, are we sure we know everything we need to know? So we produced this table, but I think we stop short of telling the world or the country what's the likelihood and confidence, as I pointed out earlier, it gets attached to other results. I think a general statement is we don't really know the likelihood of that, of these. On the other hand, the reason these are in this list is because they do have serious impacts. And so if there were any chance of some of these things happening, we would definitely want to know it. And there certainly is some chance of these things happening. So I'm afraid we can't really give that kind of answer that you might like to this. I mentioned confidence and uncertainty or likelihood. This is what draws climate science scientists' attention now is given these very large things in the balance that don't have confidence and likelihood attached to them, that's where we need to go, and that draws a lot of scientific interest to it. So I hope that helps answer your question. I give another preamble to the questions here, and that's that there's a lot of complex detail in this report, and we realize that one person like myself can't answer all the questions, but we've queued up one of the authors on all of these topics who can give you a deeper dive and more of the nuance on some of the questions you might want. And Monica can direct you to those people who are anticipating perhaps calls.
Okay, thanks. And my follow-up is, I guess, for Virginia, has the any political officials ordered any changes, censoring of this, deletion of mention of the Paris Accord or anything? There's been, as you know, fear that of censorship. Can you address that? Has there been some? And if so, what and who did it? And if not, tell us.
So, Virginia, I think that was directed to you.
Yes, but Dave, I think maybe it would be best for you to respond because you directly
have
been involved. And, of course, I can say that these reports went through standard interagency review processes, and this report that you're finalizing today has been through six different reviews. So there were public reviews, expert reviews, but in terms of interaction with policymakers, I'll let David give his firsthand experience there.
Yeah, as a coordinating lead author for this report, I'm quite confident to say that there's been no political interference in the scientific messages from this report. We've had substantial interaction with the current administration and the 13 agencies of the USGCRP, and I think they've all been resolved to our satisfaction from a scientific point of view. In terms of the procedural aspects that led to what you're seeing today, I'll let Mike Cooperberg of USGCRP address any of that aspect.
We'll send an email to Mike with any questions on that.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question or comment comes from Ann Thompson from NBC News. Your line is open. And she removed herself from the queue. Okay. Our next question or comment comes from Randy Shostak from EOS. Your line is open.
Yes. Thanks very much for doing this. And I think I've just got a follow-up for Seth's question. If you could please answer a little bit more detail about whether you or any of the other scientists involved with this report had any concerns about interference from other parts of the Trump administration as you went forward with producing what appears to be a fairly strong report?
Yeah, I can answer that. Of course, there are perhaps fears. We're all citizens and scientists at the same time. But I think whatever fears we had weren't realized. Again, as a scientist, helping lead this report and one who communicates with the other authors, the word interference might have been a threat, but it never materialized. That this report says what the scientists wanted to say, even down to the confidence and the likelihood statements. And so in that sense, it's an excellent example of a open scientific assessment. What goes on in the background outside of my limited science purview, I can't speak to, apparently it didn't have much effect because the right scientific product came out.
Just to follow up on that, given the other statements from the Trump administration about climate change, what kind of response do you anticipate to this report from the administration in general, and what kind of traction do you anticipate that this report might have within the administration?
That's way beyond my scope, but as a scientist, we hope it is respected for the substantial report that it is. That's why I commented so much on the process that there's lots of places in the world to go get climate opinions and climate facts, et cetera. And for the U.S., this is kind of a golden report because it's grown, it's built in the U.S., and it's heavily, heavily reviewed by people and agencies and groups that matter. And we're hoping that it then distinguishes itself from any other body of climate information or climate conclusions and is of value to our country, including our present administration. But how it would be of value and exactly what you might expect, I'll leave that to others.
Does that conclude the question or comment?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question or comment comes from Lisa Friedman from New York Times. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks for doing this. I think my questions have been asked, but just to kind of dig into this area. I mean, these statements here directly contradict what we've been hearing from Administrator Pruitt, from Secretary Perry, from President Trump himself. Do you see this report being used in policymaking, in any way going forward in this administration? Or is this something that they – well, I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Well, this is Virginia. I will say that this report is intended to serve as a foundation for efforts to assess climate-related risk and to inform decision-making. It is policy neutral. It does not call for any specific policy action or anything like that. It is strictly the science basis for decisions.
And can I follow up?
Sure.
You know, a lot of the folks who disagree with the consensus on climate science have described this as simply an Obama administration report. This is being done by holdovers from the Obama administration. What do you guys say to that?
Well, this report has been in development since 2015. The release has been planned for several months, and it is required by law. It's a quadrennial assessment, and this first installment, looking at the physical climate science, is one of the requirements. And to meet the requirements of the law, the agencies started planning for this report years ago, and basically it's a product of the 13 federal agencies and the authors that were nominated and selected to produce the report. And we're presently on schedule to release the final installment of the report, which is the impacts part, in December of 2018, which is and the last one was released in 2014.
Today, we are happy to talk about the Climate Science Special Report and its contents. And if you have questions that go beyond the scope of the report and the science of the report, I suggest that you email USGCRP, Michael Cooperberg, who's the executive director of USGCRP, and his email is mkuperberg@usgcrp.gov. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question or comment comes from Ann Thompson from NBC News. Your line is open.
Thank you. I apologize. I somehow disconnected last time, but I just want to ask this again because I'm a bit confused. Did the White House sign off on this report? What role did the White House play in the issuance of this report?
Okay, this is Virginia Burkett. I'll take that.
Hi, Virginia.
We'll refer questions about White House engagement to the Office of Science and Technology Policy. But I can say that the OSTP has approved of its release today in partial fulfillment of the congressional mandate.
Okay.
Again, journalists, I urge you to dig into the Climate Science Special Report. The science is very rich, very multi-layered, and very deep, and our experts are familiar with it. So please feel free to ask questions about that. other issues that are beyond the scope, we are going to refer to USGCRP. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question or comment is from Elizabeth Shogren from High Country News. Your line is open.
Thanks for taking my question. I wonder if you can specify ways that this report might advance the science about the impacts of climate change, particularly on the West. You mentioned wildfires and drought as huge issues in the West, and I wondered if you could say how this moves what people already know forward.
Thank you. That's a good question. You're really there talking about the synergy, so to speak, between Volume 1 and Volume 2, that when you peruse Volume 1, it's much more foundational kind of document that talks globally as well as for the U.S., and you'll see some regional statements like the ones I made and regional graphs. But I think it's the follow-through that will be the most valuable for regions and for topics like wildfires. So the NCA4, if you've been able to look at the draft, is very comprehensive in terms of impacts. Where our report is again focused on the foundational science that allows the impact analysis to go forward and to have a robust basis. So we touch on it, but it's by far not the end of the story. And I think you'll have to wait and watch the NCA4 Volume 2 mature.
Yeah. And Elizabeth, this is Virginia. The fundamental difference between NCA3, the impacts part of NCA3, and this NCA4 impacts draft that is now posted for public comment and will go through National Academy's review is that the report's focus has shifted from national level chapters to regional chapters, because after NCA3, the feedback we got in our post-assessment surveys was that people wanted to know about impacts in their backyard, and the regional documents were accessed a lot more than the sectoral documents. And so as a result, the regional chapters will be longer in the NCA4, and the Great Plains chapter has been split into a northern and southern Great Plains, and we have a new chapter that focuses exclusively on the U.S. Caribbean region.
Go ahead. Are you ready for the next question?
Next question, sure.
Thank you. Our next question or comment comes from Scott Waldman from E&E News. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. I just want to be clear. This report is stating pretty explicitly that anyone who claims there's uncertainty around whether or not humans are the primary drivers of climate change is incorrect. It's fair to say that, right, looking at this science?
I think that's a correct statement.
Okay, so there's no nuance there. But where, in terms of the uncertainties that this report does lay bare, where do you think some of the areas of greatest uncertainty are?
Well, I think the greatest uncertainty is looking towards the future. So if we were to look at one of the figures in the report, actually figure 4.5, it's a very simple demonstration of the uncertainty, showing as you go out in time how internal variability, scenario uncertainty, and scientific uncertainty add up together. And by far, if you're asking for impacts or the situation in 2100, it would be scenario uncertainty. And what that by that means is, what will the world community do with regard to greenhouse gas emissions and/or mitigation? That there's quite a range of outcomes based on what actually happens in that regard. Where the scientific uncertainty actually we're expecting would be lower by 2100 because of anticipated efforts to reduce it. And it will respond to the the efforts that scientists have invested, much like it has already. And then there's internal variability, which is kind of the monkey wrench in the system where nature decides, has its own mind about exactly what might happen next year. But we're getting a better idea of how to bound that and to be to understand the system despite the internal variability. So we're still not where we need to be. If you were to peruse this document and look for the high confidence, low confidence remarks, if you collected all the low confidence conclusions, that might be a roadmap for where we need to go scientifically, where to invest the computational and observational resources that the country and the world has.
Thank you. Are you ready for the next question?
Sure. Next question.
Thank you. Craig Miller from KQED Public Media. Your line is open.
Thank you. I have a question and a follow-up. The question is switching to the mundane, the first one, and then I have a follow-up that's a little more in the spirit of some of the previous questioning. But we've heard here that in California, climate models suggest that overall we may end up getting more total precipitation. And yet one of the key findings under precipitation is that in the West it's declining and I guess expected to continue to decline. Is California an exception to that, or is there a way to reconcile those two?
Yeah, that's a bit of a nuanced question, but I would say you can have some of both, that the precipitation, I don't actually know what the detail of that is. But there's also the issue of snowpack and how the hydrologic system might be changing as climate goes forward, that the ability of the climate of the ecosystems to store water in the form of snow will diminish as the temperature goes up. And so even if we get precipitation, it won't distribute itself in time and space the same way it used to do, which could be a crisis for certain parts of the California system. I'm not sure I fully answered your question, though.
Well, maybe we can drill down with another member of your staff on that. Follow-up is, since you explicitly stated there are no policy recommendations in the report, and it's easy to say, well, that's not our role as scientists, but when it's so abundantly clear what needs to be done to change the emissions pathway that we're on, and the link has been so clearly made between emissions and global warming, why not make policy recommendations in these reports? Wouldn't that make it a stronger statement?
That's a really good question, and it comes up a lot. And scientists can have personal remarks about that and make personal decisions. I'm actually a very strong fan of the separation of science and policy, because I have great respect for both sides, meaning science is an all-consuming activity if you're trying to understand the climate system, and so is policy. If you're trying to decide what to do for a complex society like the U.S., it's not simple sound bites. It can be as complex as the science. And so trying to do both seems to me to be doing damage to both outcomes if only one group does them. So I like this differentiated responsibility amongst professionals in the United States, where some of us will take on the science task and deliver this report, and others will pick up the report and say, okay, we're going to do the policy side of this. And that doesn't mean you necessarily will have policy. What it means is you'll have good reasons for having policies or not having policies. And so, the other thing is that, yes, there's no policy recommendations in this report. The IPCC follows the same rule. But on the other hand, the way I like to think about it is that we're, as scientists in this particular exercise, we're being policy neutral, but we're very policy relevant, meaning we're looking across the divide, anticipating what kind of policies might come in a very general sense, and then letting that feed back into, well, what kind of science would you need to support those policies. So if you look in Chapter 14 in the mitigation section, you will see scenarios of emission trajectories into the future, showing how, like I mentioned in my remarks, how might the world and the country stay below 2 degrees centigrade, which is considered dangerous interference with the climate system. And that's being very policy relevant, but we show all kinds of scenarios and make it very clear where these scenarios come from and what the assumptions are, to do our part of bridging the divide between science and policy. So others like to mix it up, and the trouble with that in my world is that you can lose track of which hat's being worn, whether an advocacy for a policy or an advocacy for a true scientific conclusion. And so those two reasons, one, it reduces the ambiguity, and two, it's a differentiated responsibility where you have two groups working on the problem rather than one. I think strongly suggest that we keep them separate.
All right. Thank you for that detailed answer.
Yeah, and David, I'd like to add, reflecting on what is required and expected and authorized in the Act is what we have delivered. And that is a national climate assessment that does three things. And none of these are recommending policy, okay? It is a scientific basis that allows us to, number one, integrate, evaluate, and interpret findings of the research program of the 13 agencies. Number two, to analyze the effects of global change. And the law requires that we look at these different sectors, natural environment, agriculture, energy production and use, transportation, human health, and so forth, biological diversity. And the third requirement is to analyze trends in global change, including human and natural, human-induced and natural, and that's basically what this first volume does.
But there's no explicit prohibition on making policy. You could if you wanted to, right?
The law does not prohibit it. You're right.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question or comment comes from Bob Berwin with Summit Voice. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks for hosting this call. My question is looking forward, and based on what we know from this assessment, where would you focus the science in the next few years, given that there's always sort of a limitation of resources? To what are the areas that are in need of, you know, most urgent studies and research to better prepare the U.S. for climate change impacts?
Well, that's a good question. I think the answer must be a distributed portfolio of effort. Certainly, the models of climate system are still evolving, and there's considerable government support of that kind of research, both with our government and others. But I expect if you ask most climate modelers, they'd say we're not where we need to be. Part of it is just hardware, how many computer cycles per day go to climate science. But it's also simply being able, and the value of models, of course, is that they're the only way we know something about the future or hope to know something about the future. And so as you improve those models and you test them against the past, do they predict what actually happened? That gives you confidence for predicting what will happen, projecting what will happen in the future. And if we do this policy, neutral policy, relevant concept, it's those models that make the scientific results very policy relevant because they can answer increasingly specific questions about what will happen. And a lot of those questions come down to what's going to happen in my backyard. As Virginia noted, the change in the emphasis within the NCA process, and that is kind of the ultimate challenge for climate models, is to have this regional specificity for what's going to happen in my neighborhood. And these models, though, only are as good as the information going into them and or the information that's constraining them. So this is climate observations. So there's actually a paper that came out yesterday in the Open Journal Elementa that makes a case for the economic benefit of climate observations, that there is a lack of critical climate observations. And many of these observations are not ones you can take in a day. They require long-term commitment because the climate issue is a long-term system. And so investing in observations internationally, I think, will benefit, will really help move the cause forward. And then finally, it's the process that observations and models still require us to understand the processes associated with the climate system. And if you go into our modeling chapter or into chapter 15, you'll see some of that discussion about where is there gaps and where are there needs for more things. Without being not a shopping list, it's shining a light on where there's gaps. So observations, process studies, models, that's what we need.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question or comment comes from Kathy Kowalski from Midwest Energy News. Your line is open.
Thank you. My question relates to the comments that David made in his remarks about there being good news that there are ways to keep below 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. I'm hoping he can talk a little bit more about that, because when I looked at Chapter 14, it seems to suggest some pretty drastic, I mean, how drastic and by when do cutbacks in emissions need to be done? And when the report talks about or removal of carbon from the atmosphere by as yet unproven technologies, how sci-fi-like are those technologies? In other words, how realistic is some of this stuff? And if actions to be taken on the emissions side, when really does that have to be done before we start triggering some of those possible tipping points by missing the 3.6 target?
Oh, that's a very good question, Kathy. And really is kind of a nerve of the problem. It is still the case that there is a sliver of light that you could call a sense of optimism that this is a physical problem and it obeys physical laws. And so we live by those laws. And so that's what the science report does, is try and interpret these rather demanding laws down to a realistic scenario. And I direct you to figure 14.3 in the main report that shows a series of scenarios for effective CO2 emissions between in this century and a little bit beyond, and how they would, how the emissions would relate to temperature. There's a number of ways to do it. This is one way. So there's a graph titled 66% chance of peaking less than 2 degrees C warming.
And right, and there's lines going all over the place.
That's right, and so it's a little complicated. But my point is, those lines, if somehow the world were to follow those lines, the science evaluation today would suggest this percentage avoidance. But as we point out, and I mentioned in my remarks, You can see these curves going negative, that we literally need to remove CO2 from the atmosphere on some of these trajectories. And I also mentioned in my remarks, it's a bit subtle, but it's the trade-off. The later one starts to seriously reduce emissions, the more you have bought into a CO2 removal process by the end of the century. And so then now you have this trade-off between today and tomorrow. But in this report, we also acknowledge, I believe, that the notion of doing CO2 removal at the scale of this globe, on the scale of the mass of CO2 that one would have to remove, that technology, that process does not exist. And so between now and that time, there's an assumption that we would develop this technology. And I can't speak for that in detail, but in our assessment, there was nobody to point to that says, I know how to do this, or someone who said, not only do I know how to do this, I've done it. And so, yeah, we're on thin ice in that respect, that these trajectories that do give us high probability of avoiding dangerous interference have these attendant assumptions that are quite serious and are not tied down.
Okay, so if you're talking to, let's say, a guy in a bar who's not a scientist, is the bottom line that the longer actions to significantly reduce emissions continues, the more likely it is that in 50 years or by the end of the century, one way or another, there's going to be a science fiction scenario?
Oh, you mean that somehow it will happen?
Well, either it'll happen or we're going to have to be doing kind of, I don't know, Star Trek terraforming stuff. I mean, because this is stuff that, as you say, it's not proven.
That's right. I mean, we don't make any evaluation of the likelihood of being able to do this. Only if somehow you were to follow this trajectory, we can tell you what the temperature response of the planet will be. And so this is the policy relevant side of our work that the world has strongly acknowledged, and we included in Chapter 14, that 2 degrees centigrade or 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit is a very strong figure of merit for the dangerous interference with the climate system. So if one accepts the notion that we're going to avoid dangerous interference, then one would avoid reaching 2 degrees centigrade. And so then you it trickles down and says, okay, what are the options by which this system will not reach 2 degrees centigrade with a certain, given that we're emitting CO2? So that's what this figure 14.3 is, that it simply lays that out. And it does not tells you what the probability of the temperature peak is, but it doesn't tell you the probability of you actually being able to follow a scenario like that. That's where we hand it off to a yet undescribed part of our society that says, okay, let's follow this trajectory and do the technological, economic, engineering, political, deal with those dimensions and make it happen.
Okay, we're running out of time. Let's take the next question.
Thank you. Our next question or comment comes from Bud Ward from Yale Climate Connections. Your line is open.
Thank you. Thank you for holding this call. I'd like to better understand that the scientific review by the 13 agencies that David mentioned, I think Virginia mentioned that OSTP approved the release of this of the CSSR today. But did the 13 agencies individually, I assume they didn't play equal roles or equally aggressive roles, if you will, did the 13 agencies also get individual say on whether or not they individually thought the report should be released today as it has been? And if so, please characterize EPA's role in that review.
Hey, Bud, this is Virginia. I would defer, you know, to an individual agency perspective to you, for you to go to the individual agencies. But all of the agencies have had a couple of opportunities to review and comment on the report that's being released, and on the draft report that was posted today for the impacts part of the assessment. So all agencies have had opportunity to comment, and then the authors documented how they responded to all of the comments. They also documented, and you can see this on the website, how they responded to the public comments. So for every comment that came in, the authors responded. And posted on the website that we haven't mentioned, but there was a report commissioned by the National Academies that was a very thorough review of the draft document, and the author's response to that is also posted. So I believe there's either 6 or 7 formal levels of review that went into the CSSR report, and we're now like at level 4 on the draft report for the second installment of NCA 4.
Thanks, Virginia.
If I could ask a quick follow-up. David had mentioned this was the 13 agencies had conducted this final review. There obviously will be additional reviews, and I'd like to know if you feel that a red-blue science team review has been proposed and is under planning, if that would be beneficial to further evaluating this report.
Again, this is really beyond the scope of the climate science special report, Bud, and we're going to move. We have 2 more questions, and then we're going to have to wrap up, so we're going to go on to the next question.
Thank you. Our next question or comment is from Corinne Lynn from Lamond. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for doing this. My question is about the timing. This report, was it delayed in any way? And it coincides with the opening of the Climate Change Conference in Bonn next week. Do you see it as a tool in the negotiation between the signatories, parties, and the Trump administration? Thank you.
Hi, this is Virginia. Now, this report has been in development since 2015. And as I said earlier, the release of the report has been planned months in advance, and we have a sequence of reviews of the National Academies, for example. They're commissioning, and they've got 300 nominations for a review of the NCA 4 Volume 2 report already. And so in order to accommodate those reviews and produce this quadrennial assessment in 2018 as planned, we've stuck with the schedule. And so, as I said, this is independent of anything going on with the COP or anything like that. This is the schedule that we've adhered to throughout the process.
Okay, next to the next question.
Thank you. And our final question comes from Craig Miller from KQED Public Media. Your line is open.
Thanks. I'm just curious of all of the trends and findings in this report, if there's anything that jumps out at you as a sort of item of greatest concern. Would it be the extreme weather events, the sea level rise? Is it possible to like pull one thing out and say this is our greatest concern right now?
Well, that's a good question. I don't really do that distinction in my own mind. I think it really depends which neighborhood you live in. And I'd really say it's kind of the combination of temperature, precipitation, and sea level, where you've mixed in extreme events into those 3 variables. And any point, any pin you put in the map of the U.S., one would want to evaluate those 3 dimensions in terms of what are the projections for the future. And depending on where you are, you'll have a different level of concern or urgency or panic. And so I think it's hard to pick one variable. It is true that, the temperature, everything seems to scale with temperature, that the warmer we make the planet, the more energy that's in the climate system, everything seems to get worse, at least for somebody. So I wouldn't try and pick a winner in that respect. And I think that's what the National Climate Assessment Volume 2 will do, is give them the ability to orient in this 3-dimensional space. Maybe you want to make it more dimensions, temperature, precipitation, sea level, to see what impacts will be of significance for that particular place.
All right. Thank you, and thanks for doing this.
Thank you all. Well, I just want to thank our speakers for their time and the journalists for their participation today in this conference call. As a reminder, detailed information and downloadable graphics can be found on the U.S. GCRP, the U.S. Global Change Research Program website, and that is at science2017.globalchange.gov. And the drafts of the two reports that are out for draft, the fourth National Climate Assessment and the State of the Carbon Cycle, those can be found at review.globalchange.gov. And please keep in mind that those drafts are in draft format and for public review and not intended for quoting or citing or distributing beyond the purpose of making public comments. If you have any more questions or informational needs, I want you to feel free to email me or Brady Phillips. My email is monica.allen@noaa.gov, and Brady's is brady.phillips, P-H-I-L-L-I-P-S, at noaa.gov. You can also call me at 301-734-1123. If you're interested in talking with authors of the chapters, we're happy to try to facilitate that. So please contact us. And that will be all for our call today. Thank you again.
Thank you. That concludes today's conference call. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time.